Good morning. We are on for argument this morning in case number 86892, Olson versus Mid-Century Insurance Company et al. Justice Perigary had a little travel snafu this morning, but he will be participating in the decision. He'll listen to the argument. So, with that, are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 7 minutes.
Okay. And so, we have the 15-minute argument aside, plus an extra 2 minutes, which you get at the very beginning uninterrupted. So a total of 17 minutes of time. You won't be uninterrupted during the first 2 minutes. As to the 7 minutes you're reserving, once it gets down to the 7-minute mark, you'll hear the tone and the yellow light will come on, but the clock still keeps ticking down while you're still at the podium. So if you're there when it gets to zero, there isn't any time left for a rebuttal. You understand that? All right. And
We would like to reserve 5 minutes for our cross appeal rebuttal.
Thank you for reminding me about that. Okay. So similar, I hope you were listening because the same thing will apply to you. Okay, right. I forgot about the cross appeal. That's helpful to remember. All right, counsel, why don't you come on up?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Matthew Bannon for the appellant, Lane Olson. May it please the court. There's three issues I'd like to highlight today. In Century Surety versus Andrew, this court determined that insured must take all reasonable means to mitigate an insurer's refusal to defend. This court is now requested to review de novo whether there was sufficient evidence to support an avoidance of damage verdict in this case. The jury found that Ms. McFetridge would necessarily expend $42,500 to defend herself against Farmers. That is an extraordinary sum for the average American. When Farmers located Ms. McFetridge, she was living in a weekly hotel. She didn't have a car. She didn't have a home. It had been foreclosed. Farmers knew that because it had insured the home when it was foreclosed. Despite that, that was the only evidence. There was no evidence that she had any extraordinary funds, that she was wealthy, that she could defend herself. Despite that, the jury found that she would have to necessarily expend that. Because of that, we'd ask that that verdict be reversed. We specifically went through and put the special verdict so we could reverse specific findings like this without disturbing the rest of the jury's verdict. The second issue I'd like to point out is the bad faith verdict. We ask that that be reversed as well. Instruction 55 was an erroneous statement of the law. It was erroneous because this case was primarily, while it did have duty to indemnify, it was a breach of the duty to defend case. The instruction was that if there's a genuine dispute as to coverage, there cannot be any bad faith. Well, when you have a duty to defend, it's not triggered by coverage, it's triggered by a potential for coverage. So even if there's a dispute, you still have to defend the insured. The district court also erred in allowing Farmers' expert to get up and testify, despite the district court finding there was potential for coverage, despite Farmers finding that there was potential for coverage, that the Farmers could still look at the facts. It didn't have to confine itself to the four corners of the complaint and the policy. So despite the legal findings, Farmers' expert got up and gave a legal conclusion that you could go beyond the policy and the complaint and look at the facts of the case to find that there was no coverage. That materially prejudiced Ms. McFetridge's and by assignment Mr. Olson's substantive rights. The district court also erred by not compelling a litigation hold. There was a dispute about spoliation of a service request where the documentation of why Farmers decided to refund the money rather than reforming Ms. McFetridge's policy, like how much money it would have cost to insure the replacement vehicle and compare that to what she'd been paying in premium, because the court found there was no prejudice found here that she didn't notify Farmers about the replacement vehicle, because Farmers could not produce any evidence to what the change in premium would have been. Despite that, the district court erred because it didn't address whether or not litigation holds had to be produced. It didn't even address the issue, and it didn't apply a standard for when litigation holds need to be produced. And we cited Kanata and Wyndham, and we would like some clarification on that issue. And that was one of the things that prejudiced Mr. Olson's case.
Well, wasn't that issue before the discovery commissioner? Did you do a motion to compel there, and the discovery commissioner found that they were in compliance with all discovery requests?
Yes, that's exactly the issue. So the court adopted that discovery, because it became by extension the court's findings. And that leads me to my another error that the court allowed. The court allowed that finding of fact from the discovery commissioner, which was adopted by the district court, allow that to be used to vouch for farmers with the jury. In closing argument, counsel argued to the jury, the court found that there was no spoliation here. So it's already been vetted. That was the words they used, vetted. And that materially prejudiced, and it's against the Nevada Constitution. It's against NRS 170. When you cannot have the district court giving findings of fact and impinging on the constitutional right to a trial of the facts by the jury, as opposed to
the court. There was a jury instruction given about adverse inferences if the jury believed that anything was intentionally withheld or destroyed, right?
Yes, both negligent, adverse inferences, and intentional. That was left to the jury to decide which standard to apply. But by informing the jury what the court found, that destroyed that issue.
There was no motion for spoliation that was filed by your side?
There were motions. There were several. There were so many motions for spoliation filed throughout the case. The court did not hear those and said, we'll let the jury decide. And I think it was June of 2021. It was one of the issues. Said, I'll give you the spoliation instructions, but I'm not going to decide this issue. We'll just leave it up to the jury to decide which one applies.
And then what do you think would be the differing result had those documents been compelled to be produced?
Well, the jury could decide that the jury found no bad faith here. And you have to prove that they knew that it was unreasonable. That document, that service request, was the document where they would decide why are we going to refund our premium instead of reforming the policy. So that would be the documentation. The jury could infer from that farmers knew at the time that they should have paid her the money back, or they should have reformed her policy instead of just paying the money back. And that leads me to the last issue I'd like to highlight. Ms. McFetridge was. She totaled her vehicle, and she received what's called a continuing coverage letter. That continuing coverage letter encouraged her to continue coverage on a total loss vehicle, which was owned by the insurance company because they took possession of it. Ms. McFetridge insured that same vehicle and paid premiums on that vehicle for 7 months. During the discovery, it came out that there was a bunch of emails from management where they knew this was a problem. This continuing coverage letter was causing insureds to continue insuring total loss vehicles, paying premium for them for sometimes years after the total loss. The district court erred by excluding those emails based on subsequent remedial measures. It was an error for a few reasons. Number one, there was information in the emails about causation, that this continuing coverage letter was causing insureds like McFetridge to continue coverage instead of having the vehicle taken off the policy. The other thing is, in Jeep versus Murray, this court decided that the subsequent remedial measures would not apply when there's massive defective products, when they're made in mass. So if it's a hole in the ground and there's somebody wants to fix that, that's a remedial measure. But when you have mass defects in products, or mass letters in this case, this letter was sent out to thousands of insureds over years. They had lists. These emails that were excluded by the court showed lists of insureds, and it had
Mr. Vanna, yes. I'm sorry. Can I cut you off for a second?
Sure.
I really want to. Your time's ticking, and I know you want to save some rebuttal. I'd love it if you would address the propriety of the mitigation costs being recoverable damages, the propriety of having interest on the punitive damages, and whether we can discern from the it's a lot in 2 minutes. We can discern from the special verdict form whether they were going on the breach or whether it was on the insurance you know, the violation of the insurance rules.
Yes.
I'd like to look at the damage piece, if possible.
Good question. So we assume that the jury followed the jury instructions, and you read the jury instructions along with the special verdict form. The jury found that there was a breach of the unfair insurance practices. One of the elements was causation of the damages. So we would presume that because of that finding and because they found the $100,000 in net damages after the mitigation, that that verdict, that finding of damage was supported by the breach of the unfair insurance practices.
That wouldn't apply to FIG though, right?
That did not apply to FIG because that was not one of the questions. So FIG was liable for punitive damages based on, they were in charge of, they were the managerial agent for FIE and MIC.
What's the legal claim that ties them to that statute? Because the court granted summary judgment on that particular statute, the 686, against for FIG. So we're struggling to figure out how they get punitive damages. Is it like a vicarious liability concept? I mean, what is it?
It is vicarious liability under either NRS 42.007 or Smith versus Bellegarde. And it depends if it's an employee relationship as opposed to just an agent. Here they found that they were joint venture, but FGI, the CEO of FGI, all the claims people at FIE reported up through the ranks to him. He was the person in charge.
But legally, you need a non-contract. Punitive damages can't be imposed for an obligation not arising from contract. Agree?
Yes.
And in this case, the district court judge found that the FIG was not liable on the Unfair Insurance Trade Practice Act, yet the special verdict form only finds liability for breach of contract and breach of that statutory duties. So why wouldn't FIG be out?
Good question. MCI.
I mean FBI, I'm sorry.
MCI, Mid-Century and Farmers Insurance were the agents of FGI when they violated the unfair claims practices. That evidence was supported by the jury instruction on agency, because there was evidence that these people reported directly up to FGI. FGI had policies and procedures that encompassed unfair claims and additional things to that as well. And that theory was support.
You're saying that it was erroneous for the jury to not find that they were liable under the Unfair Insurance Trade Practices Act?
No, the jury did find them liable, but only MCI and FIE. They did not find FGI. Then we went to verdict, and there was punitive damages only against FGI because they were the managing company that MCI and FIE were their agents. They controlled everything they did. So they were found liable through a managerial vicarious liability theory.
Mr. Vanna, can I ask you about question number 10? And were you going to follow up on yours? Were you trying to?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No,
where
you
were going.
It's all right. No, you finish. You're good. Which one? Yeah.
Okay.
How can you add the 42.5 that was never paid is never going to be paid? And how can you add, or is it proper to add the interest on the punitives?
Yes. So on the 42.5, the damages are the $4.3 million. The mitigation is the 4.2 minus, because it's going to take her, if she's going to mitigate by $4.2 million, she has to spend $42,500. So you're not adding 42.5. You're just only mitigating the 4.2 less the 42.5. So it's not a separate damage. The damages are 4.3. That's what the jury found. And they're only reducing the damages. So you're just not going to reduce them by as much. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second question.
My question about question number 10 on the special verdict form is it lumped all the potential theories together and then said, what damages do you find if under any of these theories? So to the extent some of these theories allow for punitive damages and some of them don't, how can we calculate a punitive to compensatory ratio appropriately based on this verdict form?
Yes, we took that verdict form question from the CACI. If we had different damages from multiple different theories, so you might have them giving 100,000 here and 100,000 there, it becomes too complicated. That was not objected to by the defendants. That specific special verdict was not objected to. I'd like to bring one other thing up. The on a 50 A, there was no 50A or 50B motion on the issue that was brought up about whether or not the evidence supported punitive damages against FGI. That was not brought up anywhere. So that issue was not even preserved for appeal, and the court does not need to go there. And I'd like to preserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Rachel Holzer, and I represent the defendants in this matter, Mid-Century Insurance Company, Farmers Group, Inc., and Farmers Insurance Exchange, who are also the cross appellants in this matter. Your Honors, we are here because the district court made numerous errors in this case, but not the errors the plaintiff has attempted to identify, most of which were moot anyway. Rather, the district court made the prejudicial errors that Mid-Century has identified in our cross-appeal briefs. Your Honors have already brought up some of those errors. They included declining to apply the mitigation of damages rule, or applying it in a contorted way, adding an amount to the compensatory damages award that the evidence shows that the insured Ms. McFetridge never incurred and which the jury did not award, disregarding NRS 42.005 regarding punitive damages, and disregarding this court's holding in Woolers versus Barches, expressly limiting Unfair Claims Practices Act liability to insurers. There are a few points I would like to address regarding my colleague's arguments. The first is regarding the jury verdict form, which the plaintiff preferred. I would also like to point out that it was a Vanna and Vanna case, Allstate versus Miller, where this court extended Skender. And this court in Skender said, we think it's the best practice to have separate interrogatories where you have separate claims or where you have separate theories of each cause. We do have some special interrogatories, and through those special interrogatories, the jury walked us through what they found. They found, as your honors noted, that the damages in this case are contractual. How do we know that? With respect to jury verdict form question 10, yes, all the causes are aggregated. However, the jury wrote in $100,000. That was the insurance liability policy limit. Jury instruction number 65 instructed the jury that the damages for a breach of the duty to indemnify are the insurance policy limit, $100,000. Then, if we move on to question number 12, the jury wrote in the default judgment amount less $100,000, the liability policy limit. That was also included in jury instruction 65 as the measure of damages for a breach of the duty to defend. So those are strictly contractual damages.
But the fact that it would be the amount of contractual damages doesn't mean it couldn't also be the amount of damages resulting from the statutory violation, does it?
Your Honor, I think it does. And the reason that I think it does is because it was the $100,000 amount, and there really was no evidence of any damages from any Unfair Claims Practices Act violation. Notably, the jury did not find any misrepresentation. So that part of the Unfair Claims Practices Act violation could not be. Also, there can be Unfair Claims Practices Act violations that don't have any damages associated with them. For example, responding to correspondence in 21 days rather than 20 days. In this case, there just was no evidence provided of any Unfair Claims Act violation that caused, and for sure not one that caused any damages. And so based on the jury's findings, as they wrote in their own hand on the jury verdict form, those damages are contractual and they are not, they cannot support punitive damages as such under NRS 42.005, which the district court just disregarded in its entirety. Regarding jury instruction 55, regarding the genuine dispute doctrine, Mr. Vanna is conflating a breach of contract with bad faith. Of course, the entire point of the genuine dispute doctrine, which this court recognized as the fairly debatable standard in Woolers versus Barches, the entire point of it is that the insurer cannot be liable in tort for making a decision in good faith. And in this case, that is exactly what happened. And that can be in a duty to defend case, or it can be in an indemnity case. This court in Allstate versus Miller said the district court can determine whether the insurer's actions were reasonable, where there is a genuine dispute regarding the insurer's legal obligations. And here there was such a genuine dispute. And the Mid-Century Insurance Company representatives all testified at trial that they did not one but two thorough investigations, and that they felt strongly that there was no coverage because Ms. McFetridge admits that she never notified anyone of her new car. And I'm loath to jump around, but I must also tell your honors that the plaintiff has admitted that the damages in this case are contractual. In his opposition to my client's Rule 50 motion, the plaintiff said, and I quote, "The jury's determination that $100,000 in damages was supported by the evidence is consistent with the insurance policy's measure of the indemnity damages." Mid-Century agrees. And the other error that your honors raised was
the record cite for that.
That is the respondent's appendix, volume 30, and this specific page is 7144. However, the opposition begins on volume 30, respondent's appendix 7141. And so, as your honors also noted, there's no support for adding $42,500 in damages to the jury verdict award. The jury did not write that in.
It looks like MIC actually filed a motion below where they actually go through that calculation itself. It says the district court should have reduced Olson's award by the amount the jury determined Fetridge could have avoided had she exercised reasonable diligence to mitigate her damages, namely the $4.2 million, less the amount the jury determined she would have expended in mitigating her damages. So that was from MIC's brief. So it seems like you're taking maybe an inconsistent position here.
Your Honor, in reviewing this court's case law, specifically Sheehan and Sheehan, what this court has said with respect to how the mitigation of damages rule applies is that the damages that were avoidable, which the jury found, are subtracted from the award. If the insured, in this case, incurred some expenses, which have to be proven, so long as those expenses are reasonable, the insured would get credit for that. But in this case, the insured spent no money. In fact, she did nothing at all to mitigate her damages. So there would not be any credit to be given for any measures taken because none were taken. And so just applying this court's
case. Is there any evidence that she had the wherewithal to take those measures?
Thank you for asking that, Your Honor. Yes. At trial, there was a substantial amount of evidence admitted that Ms. McFetridge had a menu of options that she could have taken. She could have called Mr. Vanna and worked out a settlement and payment plan, which she eventually did to get her license back, albeit after the default judgment was entered. She could have sought aid at the pro bono project or legal aid. She could have attempted to go to self-help and file an answer pro se. She could have done a myriad of things. She could have stayed in touch with Mid-Century Insurance Company. She could have not stuck her head in the sand. She could have made herself findable so she would have known that she was going to be defaulted.
And what evidence is there to support that she could have spent $42,500 and that would have limited her liability to $100,000?
Your Honor, I will not speculate as to what the jurors were thinking. However, there is substantial evidence supporting the fact that Ms. McFetridge could have done something. And what's important is that's all she's required to do. There is no evidence that it would have cost her it would have cost her $42,500 to do something. She had many options available. But the point is that the jury heard from her herself that she did nothing.
But the point is, whatever she could have done would have to have made a difference in order to reduce damages because of a failure to mitigate.
No, Your Honor. All she has to do is try. Under the mitigation of damages rule, she discharges her duty by at least trying. And this
sure, but sorry, and I'm not being clear. If the idea is she breached her duty to mitigate, then it would reduce any damages to the extent that her reasonable mitigation would have, in fact, reduced damages. Does that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor. The way I understand the mitigation of damages rule is that if Ms. McFetridge discharges her duty to at least try to mitigate the damages, then she is not in breach of that duty, and then that does not get subtracted out. However, if she does not make any attempt to mitigate, as she is required to under Andrew, then she cannot prove that all of the default judgment is not a consequence of her inaction.
Like if she had called the Legal Aid Center trying to get help for herself in defending against this case, a suit against her for a DUI accident, doesn't that only reduce damages because of a failure to mitigate if it shows that going to legal aid would have helped and reduced litigation, reduced liability?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for clarifying. You don't have to be successful in mitigating your damages. You just have to try. And so in the Dillard case, Dillard versus Beckwith, that was an employment situation. And so what Dillard's had to prove is that there were comparable jobs available, not the same job, comparable.
Right.
So there can be a menu, and that the plaintiff did not use reasonable diligence to try and get one. She didn't have to get one.
So it would reduce her damages by whatever job she could have gotten as an alternative, right? So if she had actually gone out and looked for a job, she would have earned this much, and that reduces her damages by this much.
No, Your Honor, she would be entitled to her damages, that she would be entitled to all of the damages that she was awarded, provided that she made some attempt to mitigate her damages. But here, Elizabeth McFetridge did not make any attempt. And so if there's an attempt made, your duty is discharged. You are entitled to all the damages the jury awards you. But if you didn't at least try to do something, if you didn't at least use reasonable diligence to try to do something, then you are not entitled to, then your damages will be reduced by the amount the jury found could have been avoided.
Right. And so it has to show the amount that could have been avoided.
I see that my time is up.
I have a separate question before you sit down.
Oh, sorry.
You're in your rebuttal time. Go ahead.
I'm switching gears completely. In your reply brief, you argue that there should be that the punitive damage verdict in effect should be construed as awarding a single punitive damage award rather than three separate ones that aggregate to $1.5 million. And you argue that it should be $300,000. So let's use that math without committing to it. Did you argue that in the district court and in your opening brief? And if so, where?
Your Honors, in the district court, we argued that the punitive damages caps must be applied because there is no finding of bad faith in this case, and the district court declined to do that. We also did argue that it is an unconstitutional amount based on the ratio.
You add in the prejudgment interest, and that's another issue in this case, right? Then it would be mathematically sound under the 3-to-1 ratio.
No, Your Honor, because prejudgment interest cannot be added to that to make that, and nor can attorney's fees, because attorney's fees were not put before the district court as an item of special damages. And this court has expressly stated in Evans versus Dean Whittier that the term award in 42.005 means the award that the jury awarded. So prejudgment interest and attorney's fees, unless it's for an abusive process claim, cannot be lumped in for the purposes of that ratio.
But that's not true for the offer of judgment rule, right?
Your Honor, that would be true regardless of the offer of judgment, because the prejudgment interest just is not an award of the jury. And
it's part of the compensatory amount for the offer of judgment, though, as opposed to just pretrial interest. We're looking at the, now we're in offer of judgment land, which is part of the compensation, not part of the money you could have used, you know, justifying the interest. But under the offer of judgment rule, it says you get prejudgment interest on the judgment, and it doesn't distinguish between punitive damages or regular damages. It just says you get them.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because all of the court's jurisprudence has separated out punitive damages from compensatory damages and other types of damages, including prejudgment interest, which is only to compensate for the loss of use of the amount of compensatory damages.
I didn't get a clear answer to my question. Are you contending that there are three separate awards by the punitive damage verdict, or are you contending that there should have been one punitive damage award against all three defendants?
No, Your Honor, we're contending there shouldn't have been any punitive damages award against any of the defendants.
Right, but let's say that you're wrong on that. Are you arguing that there should not have been separate awards that are aggregated in the total $2.5 million?
Accepting Your Honor's hypothetical, we are arguing that the damages against Farmers Insurance Exchange and Mid-Century must be capped at $300,000, and there can be no damages against Farmers Group, Inc.
Okay, so $600,000?
At the maximum, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'm going to, I will give each side an additional 3 minutes for their respective rebuttals, given the number of questions you were all facing. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Banner.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to address Judge Herndon. The Farmers only proposed a general verdict. If the court had gone with their verdict, it would just be a number. We had no idea what they based their, so they waived that argument that it should have been separated by claim. No, Justice Pickering, they did not raise the issue that there should be a lump sum of damages. It was always individual. That was never raised before the district court. I'd like to point out that the damages here, supported by the unfair practices, was $4.3 million. It wasn't $100,000. The net damages were reduced down by the jury to $100,000. So the unfair practices, the jury found that they did cause damages much greater than the $100,000. We do have another case that's pending. I just want to let you know about interest, post-offer interest on punitive damages. Slick versus Beardsley, final briefings has been done, just so the court is aware. I know your staff probably already knows that. Any other quick questions before I launch into? Okay.
Who are you?
All right. So, good. So let me go.
I'm sorry, just really quickly. On this prejudgment interest, there is a difference between the post-offer interest from an offer of judgment and the prejudgment interest under 178-130. Counsel just stated that she doesn't believe that there is a difference and that it's all part of the prejudgment interest analysis, but what say you to that?
Yes, I know that throughout the briefing they've said prejudgment interest and post-offer interest the same things. We cited three, not in Nevada cases, but say that they're different. Uniroyal clearly distinguishes on future damages the difference between the two. It just comes down to interpretation of NRCP 68. If you interpret judgment to include punitive damages, then we get post-offer interest on there. If you don't interpret judgment to include punitive damages, then you're going to have all sorts of problems when there's offers of judgment. And the compensatory damages maybe don't exceed the offer, but then with punitive damages, they do exceed the offer. So if you're going to reinterpret judgment, it's going to cause a mayhem with whether you beat the offer of judgment or not.
What do you do philosophically with the idea that punitive damages aren't to compensate a loss, they are to punish? And so it seems to me, and we have the old longstanding rule that they don't bear interest prejudgment only once a final judgment is entered. Both 68 and 17117 refer to applicable interest on the judgment being awarded from the date of the offer. It seems to me arguable that applicable interest does not comprise prejudgment interest on the punitives, and until you get a final judgment under longstanding case law that's supported by policy reasons, you wouldn't be counting interest on that judgment. Do you follow?
Yes, for prejudgment interest, I agree with you. Under the Ramada case, but Uniroyal explains why we have two different policy reasons for post-offer interest and prejudgment interest. One is to punish, one is to compensate. Prejudgment interest is to compensate, so you wouldn't have...
To incentivize settlement.
Correct, exactly. And so under NRCP and the statute, is there to incentivize, or it says punish, actually unilateralized says punish, I believe. And so that's, and there's another way to interpret the statute. And if you go back and look at it, other than if you're going to change what judgment means, it's the plain reading of it allows the punitive damages because that's part of the judgment. I'd like to just bring up the expert again. We brought a motion in limine to exclude all the legal conclusions of the expert. The court denied that. Every single disclosed opinion of their expert was a legal conclusion. And so in this case, the expert was allowed to give legal conclusions to the jury that contradicted the jury instructions, such as that there's no potential for coverage because you can consider facts outside the claim. And that prejudiced Mr. Olson's bad faith claim for the unfair, for the misrepresentation claim. I'd like to talk about that just for a moment. The expert for Farmers testified at trial that there was an insurable interest on the total loss vehicle, even though Ms. McCutchers did not own the vehicle, and the fact that she didn't own the vehicle, it was totaled, it couldn't be used. That was contrary to the jury instructions that the district court gave by letting, and then counsel for Farmers argued that there was an insurable interest. It was okay to keep continuing to insure these total loss vehicles. And by allowing that evidence to come in, the jury was given the impression this wasn't a misrepresentation, that you should keep continuing total loss vehicles. It's perfectly okay to do. It's just fine.
Did you mitigate that on cross?
Yes, we tried. I don't think it was sufficient to that cumulatively with the exclusion of the emails where Farmers recognized that this continuing coverage letter is causing these insurers to continue insuring these total loss vehicles. And causation is one of the exceptions to the remedial measure statute. It's not just for, so the district court didn't consider any of the exceptions like causation that should have applied here. And we had a brief on that. Farmers did a motion limit to have it all excluded. All these issues were briefed out in front of the court. We explained to the court why this evidence should come in, and repeatedly we tried to get the evidence to come in at trial, and the court excluded it. And I think the court's view of the law and the assessment of the evidence was simply erroneous here and needs to be corrected. And for that reason, we ask that the misrepresentation verdict be reversed as well.
Do you have a counter expert?
No, we do not have an expert. We had the law on our side, and I didn't think, if I had known that their expert was going to come in and be able to contest the judge's jury instructions, contest what they agreed that there was a potential for coverage. The judge ruled that. There was summary judgment on that. The 30B6 agreed to that, and yet the expert comes in and says something different. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Holzer.
Your Honors, regarding the negligent misrepresentation claim, I think it's important to highlight that my colleague is assigning error based on evidence being subsequent remedial measure evidence being excluded because it would have provided evidence of justifiable reliance. I think we need to take a step back because there was no reliance here whatsoever. In fact, Ms. McFetridge testified that she received notices of renewals. She received one 5 days before the accident, and she testified she received it, saw it, and threw it in her glove box. That evidence of renewal had the 2008 Honda Accord on it. It did not have the 2010 Honda Accord on it. She was asked whether she called Mid-Century to say, hey, this is wrong. This is not the 2010 Honda Accord. No, it was the 2008. Then, fast forward to the continuing coverage letter, Ms. McFetridge testified that she got the letter and she doesn't even remember it. So she said to Mr. Vanna, yes, I got the letter. On cross-examination, it came out that in fact she was prepped before trial on this letter and on the package that Mid-Century sent her, and she recanted her testimony stating that she doesn't recall even receiving the letter. And I can provide your honors with the citation in the record to that. That is volume 10 in the appellant's appendix at 2385. She's impeached at 2386 to 87. And it's important to note that Ms. McFetridge doubled down. She was, when she said, oh no, I saw the letter and I relied on it, she was given a copy of her deposition testimony, asked to read it. She did read it. She still said, no, I don't recall that. Then we played the video of her saying she doesn't recall receiving that letter. The jury heard that. The jury found her uncredible, that she did not rely on anything. So there is no basis for a finding of negligent misrepresentation. And the jury's finding that there was no negligent misrepresentation is supported by the evidence, or in this case, lack thereof. Now, regarding...
Can I just ask you a quick question on punitive damages as to FGI? Was that issue not preserved as suggested by counsel?
No, Your Honor, that issue was preserved. First of all, and that issue can't be preserved in a Rule 50A motion because, of course, a Rule 50A motion happens before anything goes to the jury. So, no, we're not clairvoyant. We did not bring it up in a Rule 50A motion. However, it was preserved in the Rule 50B motion as to FGI because FGI, of course, is not an insurance company. We provided an analysis, actually, under Wohlers versus Barches. And in that case, this court rejected all of the plaintiff's theories. It rejected the joint venture theory of liability under the Unfair Claims Practices Act. And that's because, and even in that case, Wohlers, which was a third party administrator, paid and adjusted claims. It shared in the profits with the insurer Allianz. It received benefits for bonuses for keeping claim costs down. We have evidence in this case that none of that happened. Farmers Group, Inc. did not have any conduct whatsoever. It did not bill and collect premiums. It did not issue the policy. That was Mid-Century Insurance Company. And there's no evidence that it was an agent. And regarding NRS 42.007, which the plaintiff attempts to rely on, this court said in Countrywide versus Fitchner, that implies an only employment relationship. There's no employment relationship here.
Could you comment on their argument with respect to including the interest from the date of the offer of judgment forward? And that, I mean, they make an argument that both the statute and the rule textually support doing that, so that the punitive damage award would carry interest from that date forward.
Your Honor is talking about the prejudgment interest on the entire judgment. On the
punitive damage portion of the entire judgment.
So this court has said that the prejudgment interest does not...
Go ahead and answer.
Sorry. Okay. That punitive damages are not ascertainable at the beginning of the case or when the offer of judgment is served. So that is not considered only ascertainable damages. And in Uniroyal, for example, which the plaintiff relies on, that was a case that dealt with past medical specials and future medical specials. And what the court said was, yes, you can have prejudgment interest on that because, of course, you can ascertain future medical damages based on an expert's testimony or the doctor's testimony. But with respect to punitive damages, this court has expressly held that no, there cannot be prejudgment interest on punitive damages. That was found in...
But that was in a different context. That was in the context of a punitive damage award that was entered in the judgment and then trying to reach back to get it. But their argument is that because 68 and 17117 incentivize settlement, if you go buy an offer and reject it, you should have interest on the punitives from the date the offer. As pursuant to the policy in that statute. We don't have a case that addresses that.
I think that we can look at what is ascertainable at that time. If, for example, offers of judgment are not binding on a party when they are made too early in discovery to know anything. We don't bind you to that, right? To rejecting an offer of judgment that is made before there's any discovery. And so if there's an offer of judgment that's made, I don't think it's fair to anticipate an award of punitive damages just simply because it's a bad faith case.
And if an offer of judgment is made, you're going to be evaluating your potential liability in the case. Both sides are, including whether you think punitive damages are likely to be awarded or not.
Yes, Your Honor, but they're really not ascertainable, and they're not. There's no way to calculate that into what you believe your case is worth. In other words, unless you know that there is egregious conduct, you don't think that there is going to necessarily be punitive damages. And I don't think that we can make parties impose upon them the requirement to be clairvoyant and try and ascertain what a jury might find in the future based on evidence that they don't know about yet.
How would that be different than, say, pain and suffering damages, though?
So it's different than pain and suffering damages because pain and suffering damages, we have something to anchor that to. So, for example, oftentimes pain and suffering damages are tied to the amount of medical special damages. But in this case, we really don't have, so we don't have medical expert testimony to tell us what the plaintiff went through. We don't even have any testimony here at all to tell us what the plaintiff went through because she really had no damages. She testified that she was never executed upon. She lost no assets. She testified she didn't even know about the lawsuit for a substantial amount of time. So she didn't have any emotional distress damages. So those things wouldn't really be applicable in this case. And so with respect to the punitive damages, what Mid-Century is arguing is that really there can be no punitive damages because if the mitigation damage.
Okay. Your time is way past.
Oh, sorry.
Way past.
I saw 355
That's how much we're over time.
I should have taken the hint from packing up.
Okay.